Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. We are so delighted for this episode to host the president of the Eurogroup, Pascal Donohue, also Ireland's Minister for Public Expenditure. We are going to be talking about EU public finances, the outlook for the next round of EU leadership cycles, many, many challenges that are coming to the EU and particularly facing the Eurogroup of finance ministers. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I am a senior fellow here at Bruegel and speaking in my personal capacity. We are joined today by Guntram Wolf, a former Bruegel director and also now a senior fellow who has a new report coming out with the Kiel Institute and later another version for Bruegel on the EU's defense funding needs. We will have links to all of these in the show notes along with the president's speech at the Bruegel annual meeting. With that, I would love it, President Donohue, if you could tell us about the challenges facing the EU, particularly with an eye towards the security and defense challenge, but just generally, we have so much facing us. How are we going to pay for it all?
First, Don, it's great to have the opportunity to be on your podcast and working with the Bruegel Institute, whose work and research I think so highly of. So I'd say that before we think about the challenges that lie ahead, I think we should reflect on what we have achieved in recent years. I remember being a member of the Eurogroup when the pandemic hit and we were considering the future of our currency. Similarly, as a member of the Eurogroup, I remember those moments when inflation was surging and we were considering what this would mean for economic growth in the future. If I look at where we are at the moment, we've never had more people at work in the euro area than we do now. And we have been successful in getting inflation down without it causing a real recession. So there are foundations that are there that are stronger than we sometimes give a credit for. To answer your question, therefore, regarding how we are going to pay for the many investment needs that are there, there are three different strands that offer our ability to do it, none of which are simple, all of which will take time to communicate publicly. They're number one, what we are going to do at a national budget level as ministers take efforts to normalise budget policy and reduce borrowing, and what priority will be possible in that to give the public capital investment at a national level. Secondly, it will be the choices that we make about the size and scale of the budget of the European Union in the time ahead, which is clearly a decision that will be bigger than just the euro area, but the euro area ministers will be key to it. And then thirdly, it will be how we try to organise our private savings and private capital within Europe in the years ahead. Our current ability to do that is very different to other reserve currencies across the world, and how we do that through working capital markets offers the best non-taxpayer-funded way of responding to these challenges.
Guntram, what are the needs we're facing and how do you think the EU should rise to meet them?
Well, Rebecca, it's a pleasure to be here. Like Pascal, I would say there are huge investment needs in Europe. These investment needs I would identify to be particularly great in the climate area as well as in the defense area. Both require major upfront capital investments that will pay off over decades, but need to be funded up front. Because if you don't fund them up front, you just don't have the necessary equipment, be that the grid, or be that in the defense case, the actual weapons. And in a study that I just finished, we looked in particular at the defense issues and the military buildup that we see in Russia, and the military buildup that is actually so large that we will massively have to increase European military investments in order to be able to actually match the kind of military capabilities that Russia is building at the moment. So for deterrence to be effective, you need the tanks, you need the artillery howitzers, you need the air defense systems in place. And so the question is, how do you fund that? And, you know, how do you get the industry up there and producing it? And my view there is, you really need this clear financial commitment over, let's say, 5 to 10 years. That financial commitment needs to be there so that industry starts to actually produce the stuff that we need. And at the moment, I don't see in the country that I know best, in Germany in particular, that the medium-term financial commitment is really there. I mean, there is a debt fund, as you know, a Sondervermögen called Sondervermögen, an upfront Sondervermögen. It's there, 100 billion, but it's totally unclear how military expenditure will be funded in the next 3, 4, 5, 6 years after this debt fund runs out. And so my view is we need to talk about debt issuance at the European level, but also at the national level. While at the same time, and there I would agree with the Eurogroup president, thinking about how do we ensure debt sustainability and make sure that our public budgets, especially in some countries, go back into a territory where, you know, I feel more comfortable about sustainability. So I think we have a lot of really difficult issues here to tackle. The one thing that seems to me clear is it shouldn't be the funding that prevents us to have the necessary deterrence against Russia. Because if we don't deter Russia, we have a much bigger problem than the funding problem.
What's the mood toward EU-level public borrowing in the Eurogroup right now? We see there's a facility for Ukraine. We have the tail end of the pandemic borrowing program. How are people viewing that, and what are the prospects going forward?
Well, we already have, as you said, a new, very important form of common debt that's been issued by the European Union, which was the debt that was issued to pay for the COVID Recovery Resilience Fund that has now transitioned into the EU budget. So that is underway. In terms of what is the mood towards it at the moment, I would say that it is one that is cautiously positive in terms of how it is operating at the moment, but with more work to be done to evaluate whether the spending that that debt paid for is delivering the outcomes that it was expected to do. And if I look at the COVID recovery fund that we have in place, I remember, as I mentioned earlier on, very vividly, the moments in which agreement was made to set that fund up. And at that moment, it appeared to me it had two tests that it needed to pass. Firstly, it needed to avoid the fragmentation risk for the euro. And I notice sometimes in economics that we sometimes use very technical words to describe very terrible outcomes. And the fragmentation risk is about the future of our currency. And I think it is very clear that the establishment of that fund and the market signal that it sent of itself played a very vital role in preserving the viability and current resilience of our currency. So I think that's a big tick in that box. Where we are currently working on to further evaluate is how effective that fund has been in delivering the convergence aim that was there, pulling together economies that were at risk of divergence more towards a strong common level of European performance. Here, I think there are some early positive signs. If I would look at the performance of economies such as the Greek economy, the Portuguese economy, the Spanish economy from a growth perspective, I would look at the public finances of Cyprus. You can see very clearly that those economies are performing in a more positive and at a very different level to what may have been anticipated. But one of the key things we'll need to identify is what has been the role of the additional spending in getting to that level of macroeconomic performance, particularly when many economies are still in relatively early phases of drawing down that funding. So overall, for what we have at the moment, I think it's very possible there will be a positive story to tell. But I think, in fairness, I'd have to acknowledge there's still further work to do to really corroborate that and form a very strong objective view. And that refers to what we have at the moment.
Guntram, how do these debates over governance affect the prospect for future joint borrowing? The NGEU fund is not fully spent, and depending on how this goes, it may not be. What does that say about future tough decisions?
Well, I'd say the next generation EU borrowing stands out positively in the sense that it created and supported a European public good, which was about the integrity of the Eurozone and avoiding fragmentation. And that ultimately, if you think about it, is a public good. It's something that no individual country on its own can provide. So it's really about working together to establish something that works better together. I think in the case of defense, you have actually quite a similar situation, because defense is something that no individual country in the EU can fully provide to the Union as a whole, and where there are major externalities. I mean, the air defense that Poland builds or that Estonia builds is an air defense that benefits Germany and France also, right? So there is clearly a public good aspect here. So in that sense, I think the case for using joint funding and also joint debt is there also in context of European defense. Now, having said that, of course, governance is the key. When Next Generation EU started, I had a piece in a German newspaper basically saying we have to make sure that sort of the conditionality works really well. And I don't think we call it conditionality, but basically the country recommendations are fully implemented, and that this is well spent money, because after all, it's European money that is spent at the national level. If that goes wrong, we have a big problem. And so the jury, in a sense, is out, because in some instances we can say, yes, there's a certainly positive growth performance in Italy and in many other countries. But then we also know that not all spending is actually perfectly done. So I think it's very important for the European institutions to really insist on proper sort of supervision of that spending, because if you don't do that, you undermine the legitimacy of any future program in that direction.
If I could come in and add, if I can, on the 2 points that Guntram just made there about governance, and then in relation to the argument about new forms of common debt-funded expenditure. So firstly, from a governance perspective, just to give a very national and Irish perspective on it, so our recovery and resilience plan is a comparatively small plan, because we were not affected in the same way by the pandemic as other economies have been. And we're also now a very strong net contributor to the EU budget and to these funds. And what I've really been impressed by is the very strong efforts the Commission have made to implement their governance commitments with Ireland. And if I see the efforts that they have put in to overseeing really a comparatively small RRP, that as a net contributor gives me confidence and a high level of confidence regarding what they are doing elsewhere. And when I talk to fellow ministers, the story is the same. It's a story of negotiation and oversight. And I really believe then, to the kind of audience that Guntram might have to speak to, a German audience or indeed an Irish audience, I believe we would be able to make that case regarding how that governance has been delivered. And then finally, just very briefly, if I may, on the point regarding how we need new forms of funding in the future. I feel very lucky to be on this podcast, but I feel very lucky in particular to be on this podcast here with Guntram, because I've had an opportunity to read the publication today from the Kiel Institute. And you rarely come across an economist who's an expert in many different areas, and Guntram is, in terms of some of the costs involved to decarbonising towards a lower carbon future, and also the contribution that you're now making to this debate about defence spending. And at a political level, there is a parallel. Because one of the things I'm increasingly struck by is I attend many different meetings on many different important and competing topics. And to each one of those competing topics, the argument is we need new forms of common funding. Whether it's defence, whether it's how we deliver against our decarbonisation commitments, whether it's other issues on energy policy, not to mention competitiveness. And it does feel to me that an important next step in this debate is we really have a hierarchy of need, and we begin to identify what really are the areas of existential common good in the way that avoiding the breakup of a single currency is, upon which we want to have this debate. And that, I think, is why the contribution the Kiel Institute have made today is an important point in the debate.
And it's extremely kind of you, and we look forward to this report and its Bruegel policy contribution follow-up, and you can follow that on Bruegel.org. As we head into the second half of our podcast, I'd like to talk about the new institutional cycle. Commission President Ursula von der Leyen is announcing her new set of commissioners and her new work program. How is the Eurogroup going to work with the new commission, and how does the continuity of your work keep things going until everybody is set up and running?
We will work very closely and very well with the new commission.
Delighted to hear it. Sure. On the question of public finances.
I'm sure you were, and I'm sure you expected such an answer, just as I expected such a question. But in terms of your important point on continuity, I guess this is a very good example of where the value of a Eurogroup presidency role comes in. Because the great benefit that I and my team have in Brussels and in Dublin is I have a 2.5-year mandate, which is a lot longer than the mandate of a rotating presidency. It's obviously shorter than the mandate of a commission, but it does provide that continuity. So, for example, work that we have done on budget policy, work that we have done on capital markets union or our competitiveness, that work can continue while the change happens institutionally elsewhere. So some of the wisdom that I've inherited is the way this role has been set up and the length of term that allows that continuity to happen.
How do you rise above some of the institutional struggles of the council process where national interests can block key files? How do you build that consensus in your group?
By relentless and ongoing contact with every capital and with every minister. And I invest a very large amount of my time in contact with ministers to understand what their political issues are and the views of their government, which most of the time is about building consensus as opposed to dealing with a negotiation with the majority of ministers. But then it does mean that when we get to a particular issue in which there'll always be a minister or a group of ministers that have an issue, by being in contact with them better regularly, you better understand what the issue is, and then you hope to have the ability to identify areas of compromise. And that is the recipe to incremental progress. And that is something I put a lot of time and energy against.
Can you make any predictions about files where you might be able to break some of that deadlock?
So I'd pick out two areas, and I would begin actually with what I think would be the biggest piece of work that we will need to do for the second half of 2024 and much of 2025, which is actually how we implement what we've agreed and how we explain that to each other and, dare I say it, to the rest of the world. And that's what I'm referring there to, the new economic governance framework that we have, where we'll be happening at a particular moment in the institutional cycle with a new commission taking office, with our current commission still there, how we can lay out clearly to governments what their commitments will be, how we can explain to the financial markets and those looking on what is happening, and how we can predictably deliver against the early commitments of that new framework, I see as being really important. If I was to pick out something new, and bear with me, because I think sometimes we look to the horizon, to what the next shiny thing is, and I honestly think implementing what we've agreed is going to be very seriously important. I'd have to pick out then where we're going to be on Capital Markets Union, which is a project that I've been involved in at a technical level for many, many years, that offers the best medium-term, and I underline medium-term prospect, of dealing with the issues of inconsistency that Guntram spoke about earlier, which is multiple big competing demands and public finances that have to normalise. But that's going to be a medium-term gain if we get it right. Won't be short-term, which will make it all the more important to keep at it.
Guntram, you're a former director of Bruegel. You've been following EU budget rules for a long time. Will this time be different?
Well, thanks, Rebecca. I mean, perhaps before I answer that question, I also wanted to link actually our initial funding discussion to the issue of capital markets, because obviously the funding issues are not just public funding issues. They are major private sector funding issues that we have in Europe. And, you know, the issue of developing European capital markets has been on the agenda of the Eurogroup and the ECOFIN actually for a very long time. You know, as Bruegel Direct, I've been speaking three times to the ECOFIN about capital markets and how important it is to integrate them. And the answer has always been, yes, we agree. But yeah, the progress then is extremely limited. And in a sense, it's frustrating, but it shows also that it's not an easy file to move on. But I'm more convinced than ever that we need it, in particular to get our growth agenda going. Because, you know, we do have a problem with funding of growth companies, medium-sized or young companies that, you know, want to scale in a single market. We have a problem with those kind of companies, and we need well-functioning capital markets for that. We cannot just rely on the banking system for that. So I think it's really, really an important topic. It's an important topic on which I think the next commission has to really put a lot of emphasis and focus on, and the Eurogroup and ECOFIN as well. On the fiscal rules, I have to say I got a little bit annoyed by the continued discussion of reform of these rules, because, you know, I remember back in the times at the end of the Eurozone crisis when I was in the Commission actually as an official already how there was a whole process of reforming the rules. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, the rules deliver a framework for the political discussion that is happening in the ECOFIN and in the Eurogroup. But ultimately, it is the responsibility of the collective ECOFIN, and in particular of the Eurogroup, to agree on what has to be done at the national level. And that cannot be a minimal consensus. Nobody annoys anybody else. That is not a viable option. We have to really tell the unpleasant truth also to some of the peers. I think some ministers have to be clear and tell that to their peers, because, of course, in a Eurozone, you need fiscal rules and you need countries to also stick to them. If you don't have that very easily, and you would guess it, I'm German, there is an issue of moral hazard. So let me just mention that word once. I think it is an issue that needs to be addressed. And that's why sort of the rules and the peer pressure and the political agreement in the Eurogroup is so important.
But doesn't Guntram's point there really speak to the importance of the policy agenda that we have coming up? Because in one hand, earlier on in discussion, Guntram was making a very important argument regarding new forms of collective borrowing. And then in the second part, we've talked about the risks of moral hazard. This really demonstrates, I think, the sophistication of the policy challenge that we have. Because we need to ensure that for many forms of spending, nearly all forms of spending, for much of borrowing, that we normalise it. But at the same time, for multiple big changes in our economy and our society, we need to find new ways of spending. I think if I look very broadly at the work of the next commission, and I'll just concentrate on the economic dimension of it, if I may, I really think that in that nexus of the big change that we have coming up, climate, defence, digital, the need for private savings to do more, and the debate about borrowing to pay for it. It's in that space and how we resolve those different angles of the triangle in which the focus of ministers and the commission has to be. And I believe we are capable of doing it, and I believe we will get to a better place in some of these debates, but I'm under no illusions regarding how difficult it will be.
Guntram, any closing thoughts for today's discussion?
We really need to focus on a pro-growth agenda and on a security agenda going forward, without giving up, of course, the climate agenda. I mean, climate remains a predominant challenge, but let's make sure that we have the growth that we need to fund our economies, to fund our social welfare systems. And let's make sure that we don't have a big security issue going forward. So I would really think these are, to me, the three big priorities, and in a sense, I like a lot the memos of the of Bruegel to the new commission about unite, defend, grow. I mean, they really bring it together, right? We need to unite, come together on a joint agenda, defend and grow.
Two final thoughts for me. Don't forget the voter in all of this. Mm-hmm. Don't forget the need to maintain political consent for these great projects and the need for politicians. And it is a difficult environment for politicians as well to make the case for this to the voters and to maintain support for doing it. Because ultimately, the European Union is a political project requiring on political consent, and the operation of markets also requires social license, and we have to keep on making that case. And then secondly, I would also make the case for optimism. The challenges that we have discussed here are extremely serious. The challenge of security, the challenge of our changing environment and ecology are as tough a challenge as governments can confront at the moment. But we have to convey our ability to make progress on these matters, to say that we can and will resolve them, because ultimately that is also vital to how we maintain support for doing that work. And I genuinely believe in an important way the publications such as Guntram from the Kiel Institute, the work that Bruegel do on a continual basis, is a really important part of how we develop the imagination to do both of those things.
You've been listening to The Sound of Economics. We're recording on the sidelines of the Bruegel annual meetings. You can find the recordings of these meetings on our website, Bruegel.org, and all your favorite streaming platforms, where you can also find our podcast, including one we did on the memos to the incoming heads of the new European institutions and much of the research you've heard discussed today. Thank you so much, both of you, for coming on our show. Thank you, listeners.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.